He has this cat declawing Bill and just getting all this bad press. Even the happened.
Good morning, everyone. We're going to open up the Senate Committee on Judiciary. As most of you know, today is our last day that we are posted. Let me make certain everyone understands, even though it is our last day for posting, it is not our last day to be meeting. And the reason for that is because a lot of the paperwork that we need is not here. We don't expect it all to be here. I'm going to just kind of go through the list as I have it right now and let you know where we're at on what I don't think is going to be able to do work sessions. We have three bills that are public hearing and possible work session. None of the bills that are scheduled for public hearing and a possible work session will be able to be worked today because we do not have all the paperwork or there's a modification in one. So if you're here on House Bill 2313A, 2704A, and 3469, we will take public testimony today, but we will not be doing work sessions. Regarding work sessions underneath that, I'm going to go ahead and just start through because we have some of them do not have the fiscals, but we expect we've already gotten two in since we before we started this morning. We're going to be kind of bouncing around with those. So if that's all right with my staff, then what we're going to do is go ahead and open up a work session on House Bill 2310A.
Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2310A provides that Department of Corrections must consider a lesser or greater included offense of a crime for which the sentence is imposed and any other crime in the same county designated as part of the same criminal episode when computing sentence. The bill establishes that an incarcerated person shall receive credit for time served in jail after an arrest and before commencement of a probationary sentence when probation is ordered as part of a downward dispositional departure, presumptive sentence, or as part of a diversion program or specialty court program where the defendant is not on probation. It provides that unless both the court expressly orders otherwise and the prosecuting attorney and defendant provide consent, a person may not receive pre-sentence incarceration credit for time served in jail if the crime is not directly related to the crime for which the current sentence is being imposed, or for violations of conditions of probation, parole, or post-prison supervision for a crime not directly related to the crime for which the current sentence is being imposed. The bill allows a sentencing judge to limit credit for time served given to inmates sentenced on a downward dispositional departure and applies to sentencing proceedings occurring on or after the effective date of the act. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. We are considering the proposed -A3 amendments, which place a sunset of July 1, 2017 for the district attorney veto on pre-sentence incarceration credit for time served in jail on a crime not directly related to the crime for which the current sentence is being imposed. We are ready to move on the -A3 amendments.
The -A3s?
-A3s.
All right. So, Senator Thatcher, you the motions? Or?
Sure. I'll move the -A3 amendments to House Bill 2313.
Senator Thatcher moves the -A3s into House Bill 2310A.
Oh, 2310.
2310. That's the 2310A. All right. Any questions? Any objections to the motion? So order. And Senator Thatcher, do you have a subsequent motion?
Why, yes, I do, Mr. Chair. Not used to this role here. Sorry. I move House Bill 2310A with the -A3 amendments to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher moves House Bill 2310A as amended by the A3s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So order, Chair will carry that to the floor. We'll close the work session on that one, and we're going to go to open a work session on House Bill 2571A.
Yes, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. House Bill 2571A is sponsored by Representatives Williamson, Huffman, Frederick, and with Senator Burdick. We formally heard this bill on May 21st, where we had a robust public hearing. Today, we have before us just the proposed -88 amendment, which adds ongoing criminal investigations to exceptions for recording retention requirements. This, of course, is the body camera bill. House Bill 2571A does not require the use of body cameras in Oregon. The bill, however, requires law enforcement agencies to establish policies and procedures for regarding retaining recordings from body cameras worn upon a police officer's person to record their interactions with members of the public while on duty. This bill is now ready to move.
And that's with needing the A8s?
A8s, yes.
All right. So,
Mr. Chair, I'm sorry. Can you refresh me on what the A8s do again?
Chair Pozanski, Senator Burdick, the Dash 88 amendment, it merely adds, there was a drafting error that there'd been a lot of conversation to make sure recordings were retained during the period of an ongoing criminal investigation, and so it merely adds that language.
Got it. Okay, thank you.
All right. So, Senator Thatcher, if you're comfortable, we need the A8s.
Sure, Mr. Chair. I move the A8 amendment to House Bill 2571.
Senator Thatcher moves the A8 amendment into House Bill 2571A. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2571A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 2571A as amended by the A8s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion.
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Yes, Senator Thatcher.
I think this is a start, and I really anticipate we will be back adjusting things and tweaking things as the years go on. And because this is such a new type of technology, and we're just kind of taking our first stab at it. So I'm not thinking it's perfect yet, but I'm going to support it. So.
Thank you. I agree that this is one that's kind of a starting point for the state and something, as we know, will, as most of our work, is a breathing document, something that has to be reviewed and reflected on in the future. And I think that will be the normal course.
And, Mr. Chair, if I could build on that as well, specifically in terms of the disclosure of information from the body cameras, I think this is going to be an evolving area. I'm going to be watching very closely how my police agencies and others around the state handle information, because just because it has an exemption does not mean that the exemption has to be invoked, and I would hope that agencies develop policies to quickly release information that's clearly in the public interest. This bill doesn't require that at this point, but I think it's very important to get started on this process, so I just wanted to build on your comments as well.
Thank you. Representative Geltzer.
Thank you.
Representative Geltzer, excuse me.
It's still new. So building on those comments, we had it on the record during the public hearing, but I wanted to state it again. Is it related to disclosure and being able to identify that with specificity the date and time? The testimony that we heard on the record was that could be over a period of time. It did not need to be down to the day, the hour, and the second, and the expectation would be that a reasonable standard would be applied to that when newspapers or others are looking for information.
Right, and I think that's true. The other part on that is that when they have other identifiers than just the time, such as a name, will help with that search. And our discussions, I've had some with Kevin Campbell, who's not here this morning, had other obligations in the building. I know that the Oregon chiefs of police are embracing the Dash 8 and the tests that are before them, and that they are, in fact, looking at working in a cooperative way and making in a collaborative way to ensure that the intent of this legislation is carried forward. So with that, is there any objection to the Dash 8s? Not seeing so ordered. And I guess we'll take a motion on the bill. Or that was the motion on the bill. All right, so the chair will carry 2571A as amended by the 8s to the floor. Close that work session. We'll open up a work session. Let's see. I'm just going to put on the record my understanding at this point, 2845, we do not have the everything together, and that one needs to be carried over.
It's not.
All right. So just for the record, we will be carrying over House Bill 2845A. Put that down for future reference. We'll open up a... I guess, let's see, 3040, we do not have the fiscal paperwork on that, correct?
Correct.
So that one I'm going to carry over. And now we're down to House Bill 3206A.
Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, House Bill 3206A comes to this committee from Senators Pozanski, Representatives Leiniger, Barker, and Williamson. We had a public hearing on this bill yesterday. This is the bill that modifies Oregon's post-conviction DNA testing procedures. It expands the availability of testing to all felony offenses. It requires the defendant to identify the evidence to be tested with as much specificity as is practicable. It requires the defendant to make a prima facie showing that exculpatory evidence would lead to a finding that the person is actually innocent. It limits victim testimony and motion practice for testing. It changes when testing can be completed by labs other than the Oregon State Police. It requires the court to make written findings when denying a motion for testing, and it clarifies the availability of court-appointed counsel in motions for testing. There is a Dash A5 amendment that's before the committee. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact, and it fixes an oversight. An earlier version of the bill authorized testing when someone was innocent of the offense or innocent of an enhancement fact. We eliminated innocent of an enhancement fact, but there was one remnant remaining in the bill that we forgot to omit, and this amendment does that. It is ready to move with the A5s.
All right, so the A5s are essential so we can clarify that last of the wordsmithing.
That's correct.
All right. Senator Thatcher?
Mr. Chair, I move the Dash A5 amendments to House Bill 3206.
Senator Thatcher moves the A5 amendment into House Bill 3206A. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3206A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 3206A as amended by the A5s to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair will carry 3206A to the floor. We're now going to go ahead and open up House Bill 3365A for work session.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 3365A comes to this committee from Representatives Olson, Taylor, and Springer. We had a hearing on this on May 20th. This bill modifies the crime of displaying obscene materials to minors. It eliminates depictions of nudity from definitions of obscene materials. And it adds instruments or devices designed for sexual stimulation to the list of prohibited materials for minors if that minor is under the age of 14. There is a proposed A2 amendment before the committee. There's no revenue impact and a minimal fiscal impact on the Dash A2s. The A2 amendment eliminates the provision that would prohibit the displaying of these devices in areas where minors are permitted. Instead, it would only prohibit the selling of these items to minors if that minor is under the age of 18, unless the minor is accompanied by a parent or guardian. It is ready to move with the Dash A2s.
All right, thank you. Senator Thatcher?
Yes, Mr. Chair. I move the Dash A2 amendments to House Bill 3365A.
Senator Thatcher moves the A2 amendments into House Bill 3365A. Discussion?
What are we doing here?
This one basically is going to prohibit the sale of these items to someone under age 18. What it doesn't do is require them to be behind the shelves and hidden somewhere. Someone has to go up and ask for the product.
I see. Okay.
Okay.
Got it.
Any other discussion or comments? Any objections? All right. Everyone's got to be 18 or older. All right.
All right.
With that, so ordered.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 3365A as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Gelser moves House Bill.
No.
Excuse me. Senator Thatcher. Well, not only because she's going to be our carrier. She's already in my mind, and I've already blew it. All right. So Senator Thatcher now moves House Bill 3365A as amended by the A2s to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
I believe there was a request.
Yes, okay.
I did move it. Okay.
All right, so I'm just stating what we have before us. All right, so everyone knows what the motion is?
We do. Mr. Chair, and I just want to say I really appreciate the amendment a lot. I know this is an awkward topic. I do have some concerns about the issue in general and the impact on women and girls and the way that they understand themselves. And so I just want to put that on the record. I understand the intentions are good, but... I would never want girls or women to feel bad.
All right. With that said, any objections to the motion? Not hearing or seeing any, so ordered. And the carrier actually is going to be Senator Burdick. Thank you very much. And we'll close that.
Chair, you were on a roll.
And then my staff corrected me. So
why did I have to end now?
All right, with that, we have three other bills that are scheduled for work sessions. Right now, we do not have the paperwork on those three. And so we're going to go ahead and start our public hearings. Let me just see about this one here. That one there. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. All right, and so I know Representative Fredericks is here. I apologize for not getting to the hearings as quickly, but I wanted to get those out of the way. So we're going to start back at the top. We're going to go with our public hearings. I am going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2704A.
Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2704A comes to us from Representative Frederick. This bill establishes an exemption to the one-party notification rule in the context of recording if a person is openly recording a law enforcement officer engaging in lawful duties in a place open to the public. We have proposed -A8 amendments before us this morning, which apply the exemption to a person who openly and in plain view records a law enforcement officer speaking at a volume that is audible by normal unaided hearing while the officer is performing official duties and the person recording is in a place where they are lawfully able to be. We heard this morning from the Department of Justice that there may need to be a language adjustment to the A8 amendments, and so we are still waiting for that slight bit of adjustment.
All right, thank you. Lou, Representative Fredericks, thank you for being here.
Thank you, Chair Brzozinski and members of the committee. I'm Representative Lou Frederick, House District 43, from North and Northeast Portland. Senators, I introduced this bill because really there can be no justice without truth. Credibility and trust are important assets when it comes to protecting the public through police work. That bank is built up slowly but easily depleted. Whenever the actions of a police officer are in dispute, there's a withdrawal from the bank of credibility and trust. And when there is no evidence, those disputes are never resolved. These unresolved and unresolvable disputes pump up tensions in my community and communities across the country. Across the country, there have been disputed police encounters in which independent video records have helped illuminate the truth. The positive effect on the trust bank may not be immediate, but in the long run, truth is better than conjecture, especially in an environment in which assumptions are polarized. These disputes undermine the work of all officers and contribute to escalating tensions. Now, I raise these issues and introduce this and other bills because I believe that the policing function is vital to a civil society, and anything that undermines its credibility should concern us all. It's not always the case that these independent videos, or for that matter, dash cams or body cam videos, contradict officers' accounts. They can also corroborate them. And in those instances are good for the community as well. But either way, truth is better than conjecture. We will still argue about what the facts mean, but the more the facts themselves are settled, the more productive those discussions can be. Now, this bill doesn't do anything that a lot of people don't already believe is legal. It also doesn't give permission for anyone to interfere with police work. It only allows a person to record a conversation that they are already permitted to hear. Please note that this bill only covers recordings openly made in a place where the person making the recording is allowed to be, a place where they're already hearing the words exchanged. In other words, we're talking about recording activities that are no more private in nature than our duties right here, which are streamed and recorded for all to see. It simply says that someone recording such a conversation is not violating the law that covers electronic eavesdropping or wiretapping. Kimberly McCullough of the ACLU has provided an excellent written explanation of what the bill will and won't do when amended by the proposed A8 amendment. I urge you to adopt the -A8 amendment to House Bill 2704A and send it to the Senate floor with a do pass recommendation. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, thank you. Any questions for Representative Frederick? Lou, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, I'm going to go ahead and call up our next panel, Kimberly McCullough, Gail Meyer, and Michael Salvaggio.
Good afternoon, or good morning, Chair Brzozinski, members of the committee. My name is Kimberly McCullough. I'm here on behalf of the ACLU of Oregon. I want to start out with just a little bit of context, which is that there has been a lot of litigation around the country over the past 10, 15 years regarding the right of individuals of the public to record on-duty law enforcement. And there's a general consensus that has been reached from that litigation, which is that individuals do have a right under the First Amendment to record law enforcement. moment when those officers are engaged in their official duties. The unfortunate situation, however, is that interference with that right to record does happen with a great amount of frequency. It's not every officer. There's, I would say the majority of officers know that people have the right to record. There are also a lot of different police departments that do a good job of training their officers, but the unfortunate reality is that there still are many officers who do interfere with the right to record. You can just get on YouTube or the internet and do some quick searches, and you'll find many examples of that. Eavesdropping statutes have been one of those methods, along with other different types of charges or just telling people to stop recording. And many of those eavesdropping statutes around the country have actually been struck down. Two very significant statutes being Maryland and Illinois, which were struck down by circuit courts of appeal, federal circuit courts of appeal, as applied to recording of on-duty police. Oregon's law is a little different than some of the other eavesdropping laws in its language, but what it does is it requires an individual to specifically inform all parties to a conversation before they can record that conversation. That language has been interpreted by Oregon courts to mean that someone has to provide unequivocal warning. So that means they have to actually do something to get the officer's attention to inform them that they're recording. And there's a problem with that, and that's this, that people pull out their phone when they see law enforcement engaged in some sort of activity, and they hold up the phone and they start recording. They don't say something when they do that. They don't say, hey, I'm recording. They just hold up their phone. And the reason they do that is because they know they have a right to do that, and because courts around the country have said that they have a right to do that. So people are technically violating Oregon's law, don't even actually realize it. The other reason that it's problematic is because it's not always safe to tell an officer that you're recording them. Say, for example, an officer is engaged in some sort of excessive use of force, or you think they're engaged in an excessive use of force, and you hold up your phone and start recording, and then you say, hey, I'm recording you, you're now drawing that officer's attention to yourself. And so that may not be a safe situation if there's some sort of misconduct occurring. Another situation could be an officer that's not engaged in misconduct. They're doing absolutely what they should be doing, but it's a dangerous situation for them, and they need to be paying attention. And if there's a bunch of people standing around yelling at them about how they're recording, that actually is distracting to the officer. Those officers would frequently hope that people would just stand by quietly while they're engaged in some sort of complicated activity. I'd like to also just point out that eavesdropping statutes were initially enacted around the country in order to protect individuals from other individuals and from the government, but primarily from the government. The eavesdropping statutes actually popped up after the Katz decision, which held that people have a reasonable expectation of privacy and that that's the standard for searches by government. And that was actually when these laws popped up. And so using them to prosecute people for recording law enforcement really turns the whole purpose on its head, and that's one of the main reasons that courts have given for striking down these laws. So this particular bill is important, and it's not necessarily important because this law is being used all over Oregon a lot to prosecute people. In fact, it has been used in the past, and we haven't gotten very many reports in recent years of its happening, but the fact that it's on the books is having a chilling effect. And I can give you a really tangible example of that. We have a phone application called Mobile Justice that the ACLU of Oregon launched earlier this year or last year, and when we decided to launch that phone application, it basically allows you to record law enforcement, and when you're done recording, it gets uploaded to the ACLU immediately. And I was actually not working for the ACLU when that phone app was being developed, but I was a cooperating attorney. And the advice I gave to the ACLU at that time was, don't include audio, because you're putting people in the position of technically violating the law. They're then going to have to face those criminal charges. My feeling is that you could challenge that in court and get it overturned, but the fact that somebody is going to then face those charges, is it has a chilling effect, and it's something we don't want to put people in that kind of a danger. So the legislature is really in a good position to fix this so that somebody doesn't have to face those criminal charges and go to court to fight it. So this bill was introduced by Representative Frederick. After that point, Representative Barker took a very keen interest in it and worked very closely with us, and we gained a number of about 10 additional sponsors from the House side. We worked a lot to fix up the bill. It wasn't exactly perfect when it was passed over on the House side, but Barker made a commitment to work through it and get everything set out. Basically, it requires a person to be recording openly and in plain view. That way, if the officer actually did look at them, they would see that they were recording. This is intended to prevent surreptitious recording. I would just like to note on the record that we do think that certain surreptitious recordings of law enforcement are constitutionally protected. There are a number of cases exploring that, but because of concerns of members of the House committee and other people who have looked at the bill, we decided to just leave that to the courts to decide on a case-by-case basis. The person also needs to be in a place where they have a right to be. The bill on the House side had that as a public place, but then we discussed it further, and it would mean that somebody in their own home would have a less of a right to record than they would on the sidewalk in front of their home, and that doesn't really make sense. Plus, the courts around the country have really held that this is you have the right when you're somewhere that you have a right to be. There was some concerns that might make people think that they could interfere with police. So we just added a provision that says that this doesn't authorize you to interfere. It doesn't authorize you to trespass. And then there were some concerns that someone would maybe use like a high powered boom microphone and be standing somewhere really far away from law enforcement. And maybe they'd technically be openly recording, but the officer wouldn't even be able to see what they were doing. And so that was where the language that the officer be speaking at an audible volume was added. Talking to DOJ and the chiefs of police, the sentence that sort of explains what the exemption is kind of a long run-on sentence, and so it's a little bit difficult to understand. So the wording is just a bit awkward, and so Michael Slauson from DOJ is actually working on some language that we can hopefully get into an amendment that just breaks it down real clear and makes it all just clear to people so that they can interpret it well. So the DOJ and chiefs of police wanted me to communicate as well that they do support the bill as it will be amended, and the substance really won't be any different. So thank you.
All right, thank you. Who's next?
Okay. Thank you. Chair Pozanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. There's been a lot of work that's gone into this bill, and happily it wasn't done by me. But I have to tell you that OCDLA is very pleased with the outcome and the product. We think it's a very good bill. Ms. McCullough from the ACLU talked about the chilling effect of having the current statute on the books. What we see occasionally now, still arrests for this, but then the district attorneys take a second look at it and then they choose not to prosecute. But the arrest itself can be very consequential to someone. Their booking photo can end up on mugshots.com and whatnot. And so best to just clean it up and have it comport with constitutional permissible boundaries. So good bill. We appreciate it very much. Thank you.
Michael?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Michael Silvaggio with the Oregon Coalition of Police and Sheriffs. I'll be very brief since I think my colleagues said most of it already. We believe that 2704 is a good bill. It's well put together. We recognize that our public safety officers rely in large part on a relationship with the public to effectively do their job, and we expect all of our officers to conduct themselves in a manner befitting that trust. Filming police officers while in public, while on duty, does not in and of itself impede officers' ability to do their jobs. We're very, very pleased that the committee has worked to add certain stipulations as Ms. McCullough described, the no surreptitious recording, being in plain view, clarification that this does not convey an ability to trespass or interfere with officers' other duties. And so with that, I'll just point you to the submitted testimony that's on OLIS and say good bill. Thank you for the whatever, I guess the A9s that we can expect.
Well, is it the 9?
We have A8s, but we're expecting A9s.
There's going to be one more.
All right.
Whichever number that will be.
Okay.
We'll see. We think it's going to be 9. It could be
yeah.
10. All right. Questions for anyone on the panel? Thank you all very much for coming forward. The last person I have scheduled to testify is John Scarf. John, why don't you come forward? Is there anyone else who wants to testify today on House Bill 2704A? Kevin, why don't you come up as well? John, I'm going to let you go first. Uh-oh, looks like you brought exhibits.
Nope. Just a reminder.
All righty. John?
Okay, my name is John Lloyd Scarf. In this particular case, I am associated with a group called Cop Block, although I think that's an unfortunate name. Our intent is public safety, and we do record things that officers do when they act outside the scope of their employment. I think that this particular bill will be helpful in terms of making them aware that they are acting outside the scope of their employment when they try to restrict you. I have been told by an officer that I can't do this without their permission, and that was from an officer in this city when I was trying to record a swarm of them who had come to a guy's house, a black guy, and they seemed really intent and intense when they came into this situation, as they always are in a domestic situation. But when you add that to a mob of guys wearing uniforms, that can get out of control very quickly. They kept trying to maneuver him away from the sidewalk where I was standing, and then they wouldn't let me stand on the sidewalk where I could see. They essentially made an underlying threat to coerce me, and my thought was at the time that that's a felony. If an officer coerces me from doing something that is legal, an act that is legal, or being in a place that is legal, and tries to restrain me from doing it, that is a felony, and there is no exemption for police. Now, I could have gone and filed charges on this officer, but this officer, I'm sure, didn't know that if one of us is there, that is enough to have permission. And since he was talking to me and I had already been talking to the suspect, I don't know how he ended up being a suspect at his own house, but he was, then he started to coerce me, which was in violation of the law, a felony. Okay. Now, this erodes a bit on the qualified immunity that officers have. They will become responsible directly for this once they are informed that that you are openly recording, you know, that if you're openly recording, you're allowed to do it. Then it will erode that, and it will take, I think, the civil liabilities off of the local cities. And that's what I see as the best thing about this bill. You can talk all about all these other issues. But the bottom line is taxpayers do not want to be responsible for when an officer decides to misinterpret the law.
Okay. Thank you. Kevin?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Kevin Campbell. I'm the executive director of the Oregon Association Chiefs of Police, here today to speak in favor of House Bill 2704 with the expected -9 amendments. And I see that Michael Slauson's here, which means he probably has already done the work of drafting up some language, and really the design of the language is just to make it clearer in the structure and clearer in the language what we're really talking about. I did want to put one concern on the record. It doesn't impact my support for the bill today, but it's something I'd like to flag for the record. And that is the one area that we couldn't quite seem to address in any bill is a situation that may seem unlikely, but officers do have personal lives. And so a situation where two uniformed officers are taking a break, they can be discussing any number of things, including family, and, you know, it can be the kind of things that represent personal discussions that they have not or no expectation that they are being recorded at that time. And yet, even with the language of the bill we've established, someone could stand in proximity to their conversation and record it. And for the record, I just want to put that concern out there. It's something that we couldn't figure out a way of really addressing in the language. So That being said, we do support the bill. We think it does meet the kind of the expectation of the world we live in right now that officers will expect and should be expecting to be recorded. And I think it creates the right kind of balance and draws the proper line to avoid surreptitious recording where an officer does not know and does not have an expectation they're being recorded. So, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thanks for your patience in allowing us to take just one more shot at clarifying the amendment.
You bet. Any questions?
Yeah,
Senator Thatcher.
Question, actually, thank you. I'm confused a little bit about the surreptitious recording. Would something like me recording from a hotel window of a demonstration and a police action out on the road in front of me, would that be surreptitious? Because they wouldn't necessarily see me in the window doing it.
Chair Brzezinski and Senator Thatcher, the my interpretation of that would be as long as it's just video footage, that would not be in violation of the law currently. If you were instead, you had a boom mic and you were focusing in on an officer having a conversation or something like that, where audio recordings involved, then I would say that it was. Currently you can videotape, I think, from anywhere, and there is no restriction on that. We're really talking about the audio recording and that specific part of the law.
Okay, so just to follow up. So if they're shouting, but broadcasting their voice over their speaker, and it's being picked up with a normal, iPhone or whatever, that would not count as surreptitious recording.
Mr. Chair and Senator Thatcher, I don't believe so.
Thank you.
Any other questions or comments? All right, I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2704A. As I stated, this one, as we know, isn't quite ready for prime time. We're waiting for the amendment, and then we need the paperwork. So we're going to open up a public hearing on House Bill 2313A.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 2313A comes to this committee from the House Interim Judiciary Committee. The bill creates a new offense for those who are under the age of 21 who consume, purchase, attempt to purchase, or acquire marijuana items. It provides exemptions, declares emergency, and is effective upon passage. There are two proposed amendments before the committee. The proposed -4 amendment replaces the measure. That amendment would authorize the Oregon Youth Authority and juvenile departments to disclose and provide copies of reports and other relevant materials to the Department of Corrections in certain circumstances. It declares an emergency, is effective upon passage, and it would sunset on June 30th, 2017. The proposed -5 amendment incorporates the -4 amendment and the underlying bill. We don't have the fiscal paperwork back on the amendments yet.
All right. So I have a number of people who want to give testimony. I'm going to try to do this in a kind of a block group. So Roger Nyquist, Tori Lynn, and Susie Osborne. Why don't you all three come up? Roger, are you going to start off?
Sure.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, Senators, thank you for the opportunity. For the record, my name is Roger Nyquist. I'm a Linn County Commissioner and representing Linn County before you this morning. I'd like to just briefly tell you how we got to this point. In January of 2014, Principal Osborne, is the principal at West Albany High School, expressed to me she had a rough morning, spent most of the morning dealing with students who were under the influence of marijuana, and indicated she needed help. Linn County is a little bit unique to many others in how we run our juvenile department. We actually have juvenile counselors in our high schools. We've had great results with that. We've been doing it about 10 years. It makes sense. It's where the kids are. At any rate, then, I expressed to our juvenile director, Tori Lynn, who's here today, that the situation wasn't acceptable and that the juvenile department ought to be helping in this regard. And to my shock, Tori told me that it's not against the law for young people to show up for school stoned, or anywhere else for that matter, that today it's not against the law for kids to have marijuana in their system. It's been a problem in our community, communities around Oregon, for years, and it needs to be addressed. So this was prior to Measure 92 happening, and then that whole conversation happened, and we were a bit surprised that it wasn't addressed in all of that conversation. So we then engaged in a conversation with Representative Andy Olson, got the process rolling. This bill passed the House 60-0. We think it's good public policy. Our intent is to not be punitive with our youth. It's to get them the help they need as they begin to exhibit behavior that indicates they're headed down the wrong path. And if we can't get to them in their youth as soon as they exhibit these behaviors, the longer time goes, the less likely we are to be successful, and we'll deal with them on the other end as adults in the correctional system. It's an important issue and an important bill, and I thank you for the opportunity this morning.
Chair Przanski, my name is Tori Lynn. I'm the Juvenile Department Director for Linn County. I'm also the legislative chair for the Oregon Juvenile Department Directors Association. Thank you for the opportunity to talk about this. As you've heard, this is not a new issue. It's an issue that's been going on for some time. And in conversations that I've had with school administrators in our county, you know, this issue comes up as we have laws on the books for minor in possession of alcohol by consumption. This would kind of equal that playing field as the state moves forward with legalizing marijuana. It seems to be a lot of it being treated as alcohol or kind of mirroring those systems. We need to also involve that juvenile piece. As Commissioner Nyquist stated, the sooner that we can intervene with youth, the more opportunities they have to make changes. Their decision making affects us all in some ways. You know, these kids are in many different settings in our schools and in other parts of our community. And so the opportunity that they have to make some better decisions and help have some guidance in their youth is important. There's a Duke University study that followed 1,000 individuals from birth to 38. What that study showed that those who used pot more than once a week before the age of 18 displayed severely impaired intelligence, slower reaction time, shorter attention spans, poor listening skills. Those all seem to me to be things that would be important for kids as they're going through the educational process. That study also showed that there's actual changes in the structure of the brain. That can be seen between the brains of teens who have been using marijuana on a frequent basis and those who have not. The teen brain is a developing, growing organism getting ready for adult executive functioning. And during this time, it's a very critical time in brain development. It's also a very vulnerable time for the brain. As that brain is growing, the myelin sheeting that's covering those connections is thinner, and so it's not as protected as it is. There's also studies that talk about youth use of marijuana using at least one time a week and dropping as many as 6 IQ points even after they've stopped smoking marijuana. So it's an important piece. The legalization of marijuana will have an impact of the perception of risk for our youth. In recent Oregon student wellness data, the perceived risk of harm from smoking marijuana is declining. Most kids would say their parents don't approve of them smoking marijuana, but what we see is that the statistics are dropping, that perceived risk in the 2012 data for 11th graders was 59% of kids perceived risk. In 2012 and 2014, only 41.8%. perceived risks. Numbers also dropped in the sixth and eighth graders. In our own county, we've had continuing conversations with school administrators, as I'd said, who have been frustrated with the differences between minor in possession by consumption of alcohol and marijuana. Having no law against marijuana has been a loophole in the system. This is an opportunity to correct this by making it illegal for anyone under the age of 21 to be under the influence. This is an opportunity to protect our youth, make a statement which recognizes even though marijuana is going to be legalized, it doesn't mean that it's not harmful to them. I guess the other piece I'd like to just say around the juvenile system is, you know, in the 90s, the state took a very strong position by passing Senate Bill 1 and creating Measure 11, increasing youth correctional facilities, the creation of the Oregon Youth Authority. The system became very punitive during that time. I can tell you today the system is starting to swing back very much more to, I think, where the juvenile system ought to be. It's really, there's some accountability, obviously, that needs to be happening, but it's an opportunity to intervene in a young person's life, to educate them and help them gain some skills to be able to make some better decisions while they're in our communities. I guess that's all I have. Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And Susan.
Thank you, Chair Przanski and committee members. My name is Susie Orsborn, and I'm the principal at West Albany High School. I'm here today to speak on the health and safety and education of our students. Like Tori alluded to, brain development is crucial from the time they're in high school to 21 years old. We now in our state have a minor possession of alcohol, and it's a deterrent. We don't hardly deal with alcohol in the schools anymore at all. The main issue is under the influence of marijuana. And first-time users don't usually come to school under the influence of marijuana. By the time students are attending school under the influence, they're chronic users, and it becomes a school problem. I call it the I don't care drug, because they tend to not care about their education. Attendance drops out, grades are lowered, and therefore they don't graduate from high school. And right now is the last crunch time before graduation, and the students that we're dealing with it are those with chronic attendance and a lot of times drug issues. We have an amazing partnership with the juvenile department in Linn County, where they're in our schools every day. Parents are constantly asking for help for their students that are under the influence of marijuana. If students are under the influence of alcohol, I can deal and help with law enforcement and the juvenile department. And when students are under the influence of marijuana, there's nothing I can do except for get them to some kind of help with counselors. And of course, we can suspend them from school, but it doesn't give them the help and supports that they need. And with the juvenile department and interventions, the juvenile department makes mandates for them to attend school and to keep their grades up. And it's a great partnership. They're in our schools every day, and they're helping our kids. And I always tell parents, if we can just get them attached to the juvenile department, it's going to help put some teeth in it. And parents want the help. Families want the help, and I would just say that minor in possession of alcohol has totally helped us. We don't hardly deal with alcohol at school. I think 1 to 3 students a year, but I'm dealing with drugs and marijuana all the time. And so I would just urge you to put this bill into action. And I also want to remind you that the marijuana of today isn't like the marijuana of yesterday. Yesterday it was 4 to 7% THC levels, and students right now are using what's called dabs, and it can be up to 90% in THC content. And we've had students who have gone into schizophrenic psychosis and have been at the farm home from doing this, and I just want to tell you that it's a huge issue, and graduation in our state is important, and we're trying to do everything we can to meet the and raise our graduation rates, and this would really help us. So thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Senator Thatcher.
Thank you. Excuse me. I just want to make sure I'm understanding it correctly. So we all know it's bad for kids to have, and so this would result in perhaps a $650 fine, but also law enforcement would be able to do something to help get the kid on the right path, and or juvenile department, is that the desired end result, is to try to, you know, reform the the behavior?
Chair Przanski, Senator Thatcher. So what that does is this would create an opportunity to law enforcement to provide a referral to the juvenile department. Typically with a first-time referral in the juvenile system, it's really around education. It doesn't go to court in most cases, and those youth come in, they meet with a juvenile counselor, they get some things set up, whether that's an evaluation or education, those kind of pieces. If they take care of what they need to, and that's kind of where it ends, at the age of 18, they can actually expunge that record when they turn 18, which is a little different. When they go to court, then there's some time limits that require them to wait until after they're off probation. For that first time, offense, it's, there's an opportunity to learn and then clear their record when they turn 18. It's actually 4 years, so if they were very young, they could actually expunge 4 years from the date. But typically, kids come in at 18, and I sign, probably three or four of those a week for kids that come in and expunge their record. So it's certainly a system that's there, available. If you have kids getting two or three, minor in possession of alcohols or marijuana, then, we need to do something a little different. They need to be involved in counseling, at least get an assessment, and then kind of go from there and let that direct it. Prior to a
Tori, I need you to wrap up. I got another bill. I've got three more people on this one. So if you want to conclude.
So just kind of ending, the -5 amendments actually support the DOC piece and the marijuana piece. I think Linn County would support that, along with the Juvenile Directors Association.
I guess the point is that law enforcement cannot now give the referral because it is not against the law.
Correct.
Bottom line. Okay.
Right. There's a lot of other issues that we'll try to take up after we get the testimony.
Mr. Chairman, just briefly, I talked with the district attorney about minor possession of alcohol by consumption. Out of the 80 cases that were cited last year, he didn't prosecute one. And so then the other thing is, I would add, I have a personal objection to the -4s. Given the seriousness of this issue, given no other proposed action to address this issue, to just gut and stuff this issue just doesn't seem right.
All right. Why don't y'all step back and we'll have the next group come up. I'll refrain from my comments. Colette Peters, Christine Kirk, and Gail Meyer. Ladies, if y'all come forward, let me see if there's anyone else who wants to testify on 2313A. And I do have another bill with another five people that need to testify. So if y'all can keep your comments concise, we're not working the bill today.
Good morning, Chair Przanski and members of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I am Colette Peters, Director of the Department of Corrections, and I'm actually here to testify in support of the -4 amendments. That in no way, shape, or form means that the department is here opposing the bill as it's currently written. This is just an opportunity for us to take a bill that has died and put it under a relating clause where it actually fits. So please know that for the record. The -4 amendments would actually permit OIA and the county juvenile departments to disclose and provide copies of certain juvenile records to the Department of Corrections for the purpose of exercising custody or supervision of offenders who are committed to the legal and physical custody of the Department of Corrections. As it stands today, DOC staff and a limited few, I'm told we only have 8 staff out of the 4,500 employees at the Department of Corrections that are currently allowed access to OIA records concerning only those offenders who are serving their DOC sentence and in the physical custody of OIA. So given the strict confidentiality of juvenile records, the access we have really is limited to only the information pertinent to a juvenile's incarceration resulting from being convicted as an adult. We do not currently have access to juvenile records for those who transfer to DOC from OIA, come to DOC from a county juvenile department, or for those who come to DOC as adults and happen to have a juvenile criminal history. So you can imagine the gap in information for the Department of Corrections as we try to house these individuals in our care and custody and place them appropriately for programming, treatment, and education, as well as from a security perspective to ensure that they're safe, our staff are safe, and those individuals in our care and custody are safe. I know we are limited in time, so I will close simply by saying that as the former director of the Oregon Youth Authority and now the director of the Department of Corrections, I really understand both the confidentiality concerns relating to juvenile records and also the policy need for the adult system to have access to these records. We're really wanting to do the right thing. And I want to thank the committee for your patience as we worked with our stakeholders to develop the dashboards. And I'd also like to thank our stakeholders and our partners for continuing this lengthy conversation and getting us to where we are today. With that, that ends my testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions you might have.
All right, thank you. Who'd like to go next?
Hello, Chair Przanski and members of the committee. My name is Christine Kirk, and I am the Public Policy Manager for the Oregon Youth Authority. The Oregon Youth Authority supports either the Dash 4 or Dash 5 amendments. Both of those include information that pertains to what the director just spoke to, allowing the sharing of information between the counties and OIA and the Department of Corrections. We do not have an opinion on the base bill and are just speaking to our support for the sharing of information. Currently, we are limited in being able to provide information. And from OIA's perspective, I want to just share an example of why that might be problematic. When we have people in our custody who are over the age of 18, anytime those persons commit a new crime, it's an adult charge. And so if we have someone in our custody who has been acting out and commits an assault but has a treatment history, a volatile behavior, all that the Department of Corrections is able to see is the incident that occurred that caused for them to go to the Department of Corrections. We are not able to share any of the safety information or treatment information that the youth was experiencing or staff was experiencing immediately prior to that incident. And that ties our hands. At times, we have youth who we really want to be able to say there's a suicidal history, there's some safety concerns, there's some things with treatment that have been successful, there are some things that have not been successful at all, and we would like to be able to share that information for the direct transfer of youth in our custody, either in the community or in a facility who are over the age of 18 and transfer to the Department of Corrections. The other cases are the Department of Corrections, as the director mentions, can see information for an adult charge that may have been committed as a juvenile, so Measure 11 charge. There are times at which, though, however, a youth may come to us and then go very quickly to the Department of Corrections, meaning they're not able to see much of the history of that youth and are not able to get the benefit of the information we're able to see because we're able to see the juvenile history. They are not. And so there are cases where that just doesn't make any sense. And they're for the similar goals of safety, security, and treatment and continuity of care that we would have, the Department of Corrections would be like to have that information, and we agree with that. And therefore, we support the bill and ask that you support the amendments that pertain to the information sharing.
All right. Thank you. Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski, members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association, we're testifying in favor of the Dash A4 amendment. The A4 amendment would gut the bill and then replace it with the records and information sharing piece. There has been a lot of work that's gone on with stakeholders regarding the juvenile records confidentiality issue, and we support the outcome of that that's expressed in the A4. Our concern with the bill itself, the A engrossed version, firstly, this did not have robust debate over on the House side. I just want this committee to understand that. This was one of those instances when the amendment that became the A engrossed version surfaced on April 20th, and it was voted out in a work session April 21st. So it was very quick, not a lot of robust discussion. Quite frankly, to be honest with you, it sort of flew past me. Anyway, what we note about it is that it does embrace the notion of a possession charge being complete upon consumption. And that actually is a pretty big exception to the normal way in which Oregon criminalizes possession of a controlled substance. Admittedly, on the juvenile side, we do recognize you can get an MIP for alcohol by way of consumption, but this would broaden it further to also now marijuana and cannabis products. It's an important discussion to have because Oregon, about, I'm going to say 40 years ago, decided to stop criminalizing status offenses. So offenses for just being a particular way as opposed to doing something that's affirmatively behavioral. And so this hasn't had the robust exchange of ideas and competing considerations, and we would hate to see it move forward without having had that. I was just trying to Google what's the lasting impact of MIPs. It does show up. It shows up sometimes on college applications. It can affect college loans. It can affect a lot. We also note that when you start loading up consequences to a violation, you can trigger the right to a jury trial, even though it's a violation and not a crime. So in this instance, not only would you have community service and treatment, but also in instances, suspensions of driver's licenses. At some point, you get to the level where you're going to have a jury trial attached to that. I don't want to say affirmatively to this committee that I'm sure that that would happen, but definitely those are going to be legal challenges that will be coming down the pike.
All right. Thank you. Questions? Ladies, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, before we close the public hearing, I'm going to put a couple of things on the record because this will be carried over tomorrow, and we'll see whether or not it's going to be worked or not. For Roger Nyquist, your statement of that appears that that marijuana is a gateway drug to crime, I don't know what statistics you're using, but I've not seen anything that says that it's a gateway to crime, that if we don't address something at this point in their youth, that they're going to become criminals. Regarding the issues of the being under the influence, there is no active test at this point to, or should a test that I know of that actually has an active under the influence, except for potentially a blood test that's now being activated as compared to maybe being able to determine someone under the influence of alcohol. We do know that the studies and the response has shown that individuals who do, in fact, use marijuana could have trace amounts up to 30 days, and that at that time, they at any time during that period, they may not actively be under the influence, but they do have trace elements. And as the last panel stated, one of the other concerns are the unintended consequences of having an offense, not a conviction of a crime. Federal funding can be impacted, housing can be impacted, and driving status can also be impacted, which could be pretty big unintended consequences for the issue that we're dealing with, where it may not even be shown that someone was actively under the influence at the time they are accused. So with that, we're going to close the public hearing, and we're going to go ahead and open up our next public hearing, which is on House Bill 3469.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, House Bill 3469 comes to us from Representative Williamson. The bill increases the penalty for the crime of strangulation if the defendant knows the victim is pregnant. It makes the crime a Class C felony with a maximum punishment of 5 years imprisonment, $125,000 fine, or both. The bill expands the types of previous conviction that elevate assault in the fourth degree from a Class A misdemeanor to a Class C felony. In Holda, bill creates parity between the assault four and the strangulation statutes. We are considering both the proposed Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments today. The Dash 1 amendments, posted for informational purposes only, require an officer making an arrest in a domestic violence case to conduct evidence-based lethality assessments. The proposed Dash 2 amendments make technical fixes to animal welfare laws. And we're waiting on paperwork for Dash 2s.
Thank you. I'm going to go ahead and call up George Otulich, Andrew Clark, and Doug Harkerode. And gentlemen, as y'all are coming forward, I know you know we're pressed for time. I will have committee members here at least till 10. I will stay to take other testimony. So, but if you can be concise, that would be great.
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, my name is George Okulich, here on behalf of the Oregon Humane Society. The Oregon Humane Society is Oregon's oldest and largest animal welfare agency, representing about 50,000 people statewide. We are not affiliated with any county, other state, or national humane society. And we're here in support of the Dash 2 Amendment. The Dash 2 Amendment, as Council said, is more of sort of a technical change, cleanup. As you know, in past sessions, the Oregon Humane Society does employ humane special agents, which work alongside local law enforcement to enforce the animal welfare laws of the state. And traditionally what we have done is, and you can see in sort of page 3, animal welfare laws are defined as sort of listing them out. And, you know, if, with discussion with legislative council about a cleaner way to do it, we've sort of decided maybe to do sort of bookends, sort of the 167.310 through 167.390, so that additional issues that come up would fall within that statute. As I think this committee took up last week, there was the encouraging sexual assault of an animal that would sort of fit within that, and we wouldn't have to add that at a later time. The only substantive addition that this bill does make is it adds encouraging animal abuse to the animal welfare laws, and that's not currently included right now. So I've also spoken with Representative Williamson, the original sponsor of the bill. She is supportive of adding the Dash 2. And I also spoke with Representative Barker, chair of the House Judiciary Committee, and he's supportive as well. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Andrew, Mr. Clark.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and committee members. My name is Andrew Clark. I come from Pendleton. By profession, I'm a veterinarian. I'm here to deal with discuss the issue of the use of assessments in domestic violence cases. I've prepared a packet. I think you have this passed out. The first document is a CDC survey of all states in the United States dealing with sexual violence victimization of women. Alaska is the worst, and Oregon is the second worst in the nation in terms of this issue. I think we are all proud to be Oregonians, but this is one thing of which we can distinctly not be proud, and I think it's a serious issue that needs a bunch of work to be done. Vis-a-vis assessments, it's my understanding that in any case of domestic violence investigation by law enforcement, there is a report written. At this point, as I understand it, there is not a standardized mode of approaching the reporting process. But there are standardized reporting formats. The one I would like to deal with specifically is the Ontario Domestic Violence Risk Assessment, which is a standardized form of reporting domestic violence that is designed to address all of the salient issues in a 13-point investigation that is essentially a checklist. If a report is going to be written concerning domestic violence, the use of a standardized report across the state allows us to compare apples for apples what is going on in the state and to have accurate information that allows for more accurate aiming of laws or organ administrative rules so that we lift the floor of the issue of dealing with the issue. ODARA is used in many places. It is specific to domestic violence. I devote your attention to this, which is a very quick assessment of ODARA. One of the issues is whether this costs us money or time. ODARA is a free, cost-free, is provided by the Ontario Police to anyone who wants to use it cost-free. There is a 4 to 6 hour online course for training. Again, that is free. And so at no cost, if we can standardize our reporting and as a result have more unified approach to domestic violence, I think that is advantageous to everyone involved. This is a well-refined and very specific sort of approach to the issue. Here's a scoring form so you can see what ODARA is, the 13 pages. And it is used, this is not something that's a small off-the-wall sort of thing. I talked with the ODARA people yesterday in Ontario and asked them to provide information where it's being used. 1,200 individuals in Canada have been trained. It is in use in 34 states in the United States. in the United Kingdom, Italy, Germany, Australia, New Zealand, Portugal, Palau, Sri Lanka, and South Africa. So by use of ODARA, not only do we have apples-for-apples comparison with the counties in Oregon, but with 34 other states in the United States and worldwide, I think the validity of our approach is thereby strengthened in all respects. Our group has put together what we would consider a domestic violence shield law for Oregon. This is a sheet on our objectives and goals, a series of facts about domestic violence, what we consider solutions for considerations of the law, and training. And this document reiterates what's there, but also deals with a number of clear visuals of the issues and the facts and the background involved. This is for your reference in case you need it. I understand the amendment, -1, is for discussion only today, and that there has been a suggestion that a working group be formed with all interested parties, including prosecutors and police and so on, that would put together, well, we do not have a unified opinion at this point. I think the idea of a working group is an excellent one. We should by all means do that so interested parties can then bring back a unified approach that everyone has agreed on, a nearly finished product that we could present to you. So I think the amendment we should withdraw, if that's possible.
Mr. Clark.
And go to a working group instead to come back later.
All right. Mr. Clark, thank you for that. We won't be withdrawing. It's part of the record, but we had already discussed. I spoke with Senator Hensel that we would be doing some type of a work group. This is a much bigger issue because it does take in statewide training and all that, as you mentioned. So I agree with you. The work group will be our next step to see where we will go as a state on some type of uniformity for use of this tool. Doug?
Very good. Thank you.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, my name's Doug Harkle-Rode. I'm the executive director for the Oregon District Attorneys Association. I'll be brief. The Oregon District Attorneys Association supports House Bill 3469 as described by Jeff and is in the bill. That's all I have.
All right. Thank you very much. Any questions for these three? Thank you all very much, gentlemen. Yes.
Did you have a position on the amendments?
Oh, no, we don't have, Chair Przanski, Senator Burbick, we don't have a position on the amendments unless it's going to do something to damage the basic bill as it moves through the process. Otherwise, we're fine.
All right. And Mr. Clark, thank you for coming over from Pendleton, too.
Thank you.
All right. We have two other individuals that are scheduled to give testimony. I believe it's Lydia or it's Linda. I can't tell. Smart. And then Louise. Richard?
Yes. Good morning. I'm Lisa Swart.
Oh, Lisa.
That's okay. And I'm part of Andrew's group here, Dr. Clark's group. And I would like to express support for the assessment group. And I want to give a little bit of background on that. When the state of Maryland adopted the ODARA assessments, their lethality went down 34% within the first year in domestic violence situations. So when you look at the fact that it's estimated that each lethality in a domestic violence death costs about $2 million in accrued costs for the state, that would, with Oregon's record, that would be basically a net gain of $24 million. And when you think that our whole domestic violence funding for a lot of the programs is about $16 million, it is a really, really important and fiscally responsible thing to do. I work with the military training, and the Air Force spent $3 million coming up with their own independent risk assessment because they realize that there are certain factors that will be consistent in lethality situations, and they basically came up with almost the same as the ODARA assessment, and that was in an independent study. I would also like to add that why this is salient to this bill is strangulation is basically the highest indicator of lethality that there is. Somebody that strangles their partner even once or twice is far more likely to kill them than someone who beats them up 10 or 20 times. So strangulation is a huge lethality issue. It is akin psychologically to being shot when you deal with trauma victims. So to ignore strangulation is to say that you are ignoring somebody who's been shot, or to say that it's not, it's too costly to prosecute strangulation is like saying it's too costly to prosecute someone who shoots another person. One of the pushbacks that I've come across is people think, oh, it's he said, she said. And that's absolutely untrue. For example, the state of Kentucky has a strangulation department, and they use rhinoscopes and things like that. Even in fatal strangulations, 40% of the time, there are no physical marks, even when they've killed the person. But with the rhinoscopes and things like that, it's clear. You can tell. With the assessments that police officers can do, they can determine if there's been strangulation just by, for example, if you say, well, what were you experiencing? For me, it was like a sound of being a seashell to your ear, you know, things like that. So it's not just he said, she said. And the reason that it's important to prosecute strangulation, and I think it should be, every strangulation should be a felony, not just pregnant women, is serial killers, Ward Weaver. You know, he choked his wife. He strangled his wife. They didn't prosecute him. So he then went on to kill. And when you look at that pattern, that's clear in almost all killers. So if we can stop it at the strangulation state, we can prevent a lot of crime throughout the community. Thank you.
Yes. And Louise. I'm here from the Voices Set Free. I'm Louise Bouchard. Along with Lisa and the others, we have been working together for quite some time. And I'm just bringing in the article that I got out of the Hillsborough Tribune on Friday as I was at the office showing another homicide, suicide of a couple, and their daughter is bringing forth charges and naming three of our deputies at Washington County Sheriff. This is going to be an enormous burden to the community. It's an enormous burden to the daughter to lose both parents in one incident. And there were calls known to these three officers already at this home. They had been out before, and they knew that she feared for her life. They'd left the scene. They'd made no arrest, as they are mandatory responsible to do. And within 4 hours, two people were dead, and another person was very, very injured, to say nothing of the daughter who suffered the consequences of the losses. So it's present. It's right in our communities, and the enormous costs of emotions and family life must be considered. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Any questions?
Yeah. Thank you all very much.
You're very welcome.
Was there anyone else who wanted to testify on 3469? Not seeing, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing. And at this point, we've completed all of our public hearings, and we're going to go through and take care of our shopkeeping, making certain that we carry over everything that we still need to have in play and are working. So let me just, before we get there, I don't know where I got that list, but I want to make sure I got mine. You do a cross check. All right. So for the record, if everyone needs to be listening as to making sure we've crossed the T's and dotted the I's, the following bills will be carried over until tomorrow, Wednesday, June 3rd. House Bill 2313A, House Bill 2704A, House Bill 3469, House Bill 2845A, House Bill 3040A, House Bill 3399A, House Bill 3452A, House Bill 3468, House Bill 2366A, House Bill 3524A. Is that a check affirmative? All right. Everyone's kind of nodding, and me and Senator Thatcher think we've got it all. Any closing comments? All right. With that, we're adjourned until tomorrow, carrying all of those bills that have been mentioned. And if for some reason I missed one of these bills, whatever we had on the agenda today that did not go out to the floor, which were four other bills, will also be carried over until tomorrow at 8:30.
Thank you.
At 8:30.